about Apparent Horizons, but maybe I'm going to wait till a later lecture to do that. And today we're going to discuss gravitational waves. That's what your tutorial Monday is going to be about. So in this lecture, I'm going to go somewhat quickly through just the propagation of gravitational waves in the weak regime, then the quadrupole formula for how you generate gravitational waves and the non-relativistic forces, and then the energy and angular momentum formula for gravitational waves. Hopefully, maybe you've seen some of that in previous GR courses, so it might be a little bit of a review. So first of all, let's talk about gravitational waves in the weak field. What we mean by that is that we can write our metric as Minkowski, the flat metric, plus some small perturbation h. And we're going to work in linear order. And so that means, for example, you know, if we're looking at the inverse of the linear order, that's just given by this. And for our gauge, we're going to choose a harmonic gauge, which you know, familiar with from last lecture. So if we go to the weak field regime, we're basically going to ignore nonlinear terms in H, then we get the following equations for the Einstein equations. So this is, to get these, you can just take the generalized harmonic equations we wrote down last time and just drop all the nonlinear terms in H. So this is just starting from the trace reversed version of the Einstein equations. And this is, for our purposes, this will be the box operator. Okay, and if we just trace reverse this equation, we get the following. And this quantity here, we're going to call H bar AB, and basically we're going to try to choose coordinates, at least for the vacuum case, where H bar is going to be the same as H, i.e. this term is going to be zero. So we can note that this harmonic gauge condition is actually, for our weak field regime, is actually equivalent to this. You can also think equals zero. You can also think of as a Lorentz gauge. From electromagnetism, right? So as you may recall from like electromagnetism, you still have a residual gauge degree of freedom with the Lorentz gauge, right? So electromagnetism, you can take your vector potential and you can always add the gradient of a scalar to it, right? And as long as you choose that that's zero, then this transformation will leave this unchanged, right? So it's the same thing here for our Einstein field equation case. So here we can make a coordinate transformation. And as long as we have that this is zero, then we can stay in harmonic gauge, right? We should note that we want to keep this small in some sense, so that, because otherwise we're doing a coordinate transformation that is large and takes us away from our Minkowski metric, A to AB. All right, so now to begin with, we're going to talk about how the gravitation waves would propagate in a vacuum region. And after that, we'll go back and talk about how they might have actually gotten generated in the first place. All right, so if we're in the vacuum regime, we can actually ignore the non-propagating gravitational degrees of freedom, i.e. the sort of Newtonian potential type terms. So in this case, we can actually use our residual gauge degrees of freedom to put the metric in a transverse traceless form. Let me tell you what I mean by that. So what I mean is the transverse property is that you have a time space component that's zero, and the traceless is the trace is zero. And so if we have this, then indeed we have that this h bar AB is just the same as the metric perturbation. So that'll make our lives easier. And then finally, the Lorentz condition, or the harmonic condition, the way you want to call it. Since we already set these terms to zero, this just gives us this one term. Okay, and so now if we take the top expression, and we're in vacuum, so we set the stress energy to zero. Then for the Yeah, so it's just taking this top expression here, plugging in 0, 0, and then using the factor in a vacuum. So basically, what that means is that if we choose H0, 0, 0 to be 0 initially, and then we have its time derivative is 0 by this, and here, using this, we can have that it's basically zero for all time. So, and putting that together with what we had before, basically all the time component, any component that has at least one time index for H can be zero in the gauge we've chosen, right?
So that T00 is zero because we are considering vacuum. Why did we write T00 there?
Yeah, I just was saying that it's zero. Any other questions? Okay, so we're left with this equation, and so this equation has plane wave solutions of the following form. This Aij is just going to be some constant matrix. And then x is the four-dimensional space-time coordinate. And then k is effectively going to be the wave vector. Yeah, so if we plug in this ansatz into here, we get the following. So just pull down two spatial derivatives, gives you minus one. And the fact that this we want this to be zero tells us that we want this k vector, when it's contracted with itself, to be zero. That's just the same as saying it's a null vector, right? And we can also use our Lorentz gauge condition. Get the following. this is saying that this matrix mu, the metric perturbation when we contract it with the vector that determines the propagation is zero. So this is what we mean when we say that it's transverse. So just to make our lives easy, let's choose, or let's basically choose the direction of K to be the Z direction. And notice I've chosen it such that it's null, right? That's how you we'll get the T component once you set the Z component. So now we can write our constant matrix Aij here the following way. And so we get this basically because from this condition, we know that all the Z components should be zero, right? And we also know that it should be have zero trace, right? And, you know, as you probably already know, these two H plus and H cross are going to correspond to the two different polarizations of the gravitational waves. In the transverse traceless gauge, a particle that's just at a constant position actually corresponds to a geodesic. So that allows us to calculate basically what the proper separation between two geodesics would be as you have a gravitational wave propagating by. We're going to consider a geodesic A with the following space-time coordinates. It's just basically sitting at the origin for all time, and then a geodesic B. That's sitting at some position L for all time. X position L at all time. So then if we just use this, use our metric, we add this the flat space to calculate the proper separation between the two geodesics as a function of time. Then we get this. We can see that these gravitational waves propagating actually correspond to a stretching and squeezing of the distance between two freely falling particles, for example. So instead of just that, instead of just looking at, you know, two test particles, we kind of look at a let's say a circle of test particles. We can get an idea of what these plus and cross polarizations mean. So for the plus polarization, let's say you start with a ring of test particles. And then as you have the gravitational wave propagating through, let's say, so say we have just H plus and no H cross, then we'll basically, the ring will distort first this way, and then back, and then this way. As the gravitational wave goes through one period, back to here.
So this somehow does not have H cross at all.
Yeah, because I was just looking at the X displacement.
Okay.
Yeah. And then if you consider the Y displacement, then you get the other one, right? Okay. And then the cross, you start with a ring. Then something like that, and then back. And of course, you know, these are very exaggerated compared to the amplitude of actual gravitational waves. And like one final thing we can note is that if we basically rotate our coordinates about the z-axis by some angle phi, then we'll kind of mix up the H plus and H cross polarizations in the following way. So this factor of two here is often why people say that gravitation waves correspond to, or that the graviton would correspond to a spin two particle. Basically because of how these the gravitational wave would change about this like rotation about some axis. Any questions about that? Maybe that's all review for everyone. Okay, so that was propagation of gravitational waves. Now let's talk about how it actually generates the gravitational waves, at least in the weak field regime. Okay, so we're not going to be able to use this TT gauge in the source zone, basically, because we might have these Newtonian components to the source, and we're not going to be in vacuum. However, we still have that equation we wrote down up there. Let's write down again. And, you know, recall this is the traced reverse perturbation. And so we want to basically solve this equation you know, for some given some source. And you know, the usual way to do that is a Green's function type method, where we first solve this equation for a delta function source. So and here the derivatives with respect to this coordinate here, just the xa, the unbarred coordinate. And so for the Green function for this box operator is given by the following. And here, this delta is usual, you know, delta function distribution, and this theta here. Is a function that's one when you have a positive argument. And then zero otherwise. You know, in particular, if we're interested in the retarded solution. So basically, we can use this Green's function here to solve our equation for an arbitrary source. Yeah, so basically just plugged in this Green's function, or you know, this is the general solution for some arbitrary stress energy tensor in terms of our Green function, and then we plugged in this Green's function form that we have here, and use that to basically do the integral over time. And then this time here, so now I'm kind of splitting the time and the space components as different arguments. This time here, it's sometimes called the retarded time. Uh, So basically, this integral is sort of done over the past light cone. So say we have some time t in some spatial position xi. And look at the as we vary xi, x bar I. This radius here is the retarded time. So I've defined it here. Basically, at every point you integrate over the past light cone. So, as usual, these integrals are going to be a lot easier to do if we go from position space to Fourier space. That's what we're going to do. So here are the tilde corresponds to the Fourier transform quantity. And then if we look in the right-hand side and Fourier transform that, right, and then we can do this integral over time here, and so any questions about that? So one more thing we can note is that we take our Lorentz gauge condition and then we translate it into Fourier space. We have that we have the following here. So for the basically we only need to calculate the spatial components because again the time components for the Fourier transcut one are going to be zero.
What did we integrate over? We somehow integrated over t, but
Yeah, this is basically going to give you like a delta function, right?
That will give delta over x, right?
Right, so like this.
That if you integrate over t, it will just give delta over omega or something.
Yeah, so we're doing this integral over here, and then that gives you basically a delta function. So that we plug in for tr.
This integral will not give delta of that. If it was integral over omega, it would give delta tr minus whatever, x minus x prime, x bar. That should not be tilde, actually. TAB should not be tilde in that expression. Because we have substituted for HAB bar. And HAB there was in terms of... When you convert it into tilde into the integral.
So yeah, this is the untilded one. Then we do that one to get the Fourier transform here. Thanks. And so, yeah, here I'm saying once we basically know the spatial components of the this is Lorentz condition, so we can use them to calculate the time components. Okay, so to make further progress, we're going to need to make some additional assumptions. So what we're going to assume is first of all, if we look at the distance of our observer r, that it's much bigger than 1 over the frequency or the wavelength of the gravitational waves. So that's just the wave zone approximation. And the second assumption we're going to make is that the size of our source region, we have non-vacuum, and we're generating these gravitational waves, is small compared to the wavelength of our gravitational waves. So just to draw a picture, you know, you can imagine have some matter here. And the characteristic size here is our source. And the gravitational waves that are coming out of it are bigger. And then at much larger distances, you're actually observing it. So this will be true for, you know, compact objects that are orbiting each other, not too close to the speed of light. So if we have these approximations, then we can do the following. And approximate this. You know, this is the distance to our source here, and we're saying that it's small compared to the integral over, or the, this is the distance of the observer, and it's small over through the, than these distances between the source. And then we can calculate this remaining part of the integral that we have over here. We're going to sort of use reverse integration and the conservation of stress energy a couple times. Sorry, reverse integration by parts. All right, so what we need to calculate is this. Fourier transform or stress energy tensor, this volume integral. So I'm going to write it like this. So this is just basically using this like reverse integration by parts. So this one is a total integral. So we can just set that to zero. So it's a total derivative and then we're integrating up, so it's zero. And then for this one, so here we're taking the derivative with respect to the spatial component, so we can use our conservation of stress energy tensor, write that in terms of the time components, which, you know, in Fourier space would give us the following. So we can write this like this. Here, basically, just symmetrize that in I and J. It's symmetric. And then now we're basically going to do that same trick again. Where we're going to write it as a derivative term. So again, total derivative, so go to zero, and then we get that, and being the same argument again. We've managed to get rid of, you know, start from here and get rid of these spatial indices, and now we just have the time component here. And we're going to call this whole thing here. That's the quadrupole moment tensor. Right, so plugging this in that equation over there, we get going back to position space. All right, so we got this by taking that expression, using this approximation here, based on the separation of scales we have between our force size, our gravitational waves, and our distance to the observer, and then using this expression here, where I've redefined this so that. Right, so you know, one question you might have is, why is the leading order contribution to gravitational waves due to this quadrupole moment? Why don't we have the lower moments, like the monopole or the dipole? Again, this T00 or TT, the time component stress energy is basically just the energy density, right, in our weak field approximation. So, does anyone know why there's no sort of monopole contribution? Like, why don't we get contributions from terms just like integrating over some time varying energy density? The monopole as a function of time.
I knew, I forgot. What was the reason?
Yeah, we can kind of think of it as, for example, like due to Birkhoff's theorem or something, if we just have some, spherical region of matter, and it's just oscillating back and forth, and outside, in the vacuum region outside the spherical symmetry, then we'll just have Schwarzschild at some large distance. We won't get any monopole radiation there, right?
I see.
Yeah, and then the next one you might worry about is the dipole radiation, right? So, you just have like some time varying energy density. How come you don't get any contributions from the dipole moment, the radiation? Like you do, for example, in electromagnetism.
Has to do something with the center of mass remaining fixed in gravity.
Yes. In some sense, we can always go to use coordinates where this is going to be zero. But I think it's basically due to the fact that you in electromagnetism you have positive and negative charges, and in gravity we just have positive mass, right? So we don't have sort of the equivalent of a negative mass. Yeah, so then the next word, of course, is the quadrupole, and that is the one where you get gravitational waves. Okay, so yeah, just maybe just very briefly. Just very briefly, I want to talk about one kind of non-relativistic case where the this quadruple format actually doesn't apply. So for example, we talked about a few lectures back about these boson clouds you could form around black holes that would oscillate and might give you gravitational waves. So in that case, you have a black hole, you have some boson cloud, and the sort of characteristic size of the cloud is going to be 1 over alpha times mu, where mu is the mass of this ultralight boson, and alpha is the mass of the boson times the mass of the black hole in geometric units. We're going to assume we're in the non-relativistic regime with this is much less than one. And then, you know, this cloud is oscillating at frequency omega, and then it'll emit gravitational waves. You know, assuming it's a cloud with azimuth number m, it'll emit gravitational waves at twice that oscillation frequency. So can anyone tell me why the quadruple formula doesn't apply here, even if we assume that this this cloud is, you know, sitting very far away from the black hole, and that it's, you know, its self-gravity is not sort of relativistic? So basically the reason is, so this is the sort of characteristic size of the source, right? And the characteristic, you know, wavelength is going to be like this, right? We just said that alpha is like a small number, right? We don't have this condition, right? We can kind of think of it in this case, you know, the source region is large compared to the gravitational radiation. So it's, you could still use a non-relativistic approximation, but the quadrupole formula doesn't work basically because you can think of it as generating gravitational waves incoherently, right? So different parts of the cloud will generate different gravitational waves that can, you know, interfere with each other before they make it to the wave zone. So that's just the caution, that just because something is non-relativistic doesn't mean you can always use the quadrupole formula. On the other hand, you know, if you have a, you know, binary, some separation, a 2R, let's just say they each have mass m, then the gravitation wave frequency is going to be, you know, twice the orbital frequency. And let's say or at some large separation. So they're approximately on a Newtonian orbit. You use Kepler's law. And then we can just write this as this. And so basically, you know, as long as this separation here is much less than one, then we do have the quadrupole formula, right? Because the basically the gravitational wavelength of our gravitational waves will be much larger than this source, the size of our source, which is 2r. All right, so very briefly, I also want to sort of write down the formulas for energy and angular momentum in gravitational waves. So, you know, there's actually no way to, in a gauge invariant way, define this, at least in the near zone. But the way you can get around in the weak field regime is basically to, you know, average over several gravitational wave lengths. And that way you can kind of calculate an effective stress energy tensor, and then we can use that to calculate the energy and angular momentum associated with gravitational waves as they propagate to infinity. Okay, so the idea here is that you calculate these, you actually need to go to second order. So you have your Minkowski, you have your first order piece, and then you're going to second order in your metric perturbation. In terms of the Ricci tensor, we have the zeroth order pH, which is should just be zero, and then we have flat space, and then the first and second order pieces again. So first order, we just take our metric perturbation at first order, plug it into the first order Einstein equations, get zero. Then we're going to go to second order. We get two pieces now. So we get plugging in the second order gravitational wave perturbation or metric perturbation into the first order Einstein equations. And then we get a second piece just expanding the Einstein tensor to second order and then plugging in the first order piece. And what we're basically going to do is, you know, since this should equal zero, we're just going to reshuffle the terms and call one of them the effective stress energy tensor. We're going to define the right-hand side here to be this small TAB, which is the effective stress energy tensor of our gravitational waves. And just by this equation, it's going to be given by second order piece acting on the first order metric. And you'll notice that this is going to be, you know, symmetric, because this is symmetric, and is also going to be conserved just by the Bianchi identity again. So it's kind of, in that sense, you know, reasonable to view it as a stress energy tensor. But, you know, we should be careful that this is not, you know, gauge invariant. Of course, we're going to, you know, get around that by, you know, averaging over several wavelengths of our gravitational waves. All right, so I'm just gonna kind of write it down here. So, you know, these brackets indicate an average over time. But basically, you know, the way we'd actually derive this is to write down, you know, this guy, and then, this guy, and take all the quadratic terms in the metric, and then use the fact that we're in a transverse traceless gauge, use this fact that we're averaging over several wavelengths here, basically say that whenever you have one of these derivatives, some quantity gets zero. So that means you can use that to write if you have a product of two quantities. Now you can basically switch the order like this. Just using the fact that the derivative of the product should be, then averaging should be zero. So since I'm out of time, maybe I should just go ahead and write down the equations for the gravitational wave energy and angular momentum you get. The energy in the gravitational waves, at some time would be basically just integrating over this effective stress energy tensor. And then you can similarly define a flux of gravitational wave energy. In the normal way that you would define it for some flux of stress energy. So here this is just the flux through some surface S, and here this is the unit normal. And you know, in general we would want to take some surface that's, you know, in the wave zone or at infinity, and then do this integral to get the flux of energy in the gravitational waves. And you can do the same thing for angular momentum. And then you can basically plug in, use the quadruple formulation to you know, calculate what these effective stress energy tensors would be. And definitely don't have time to do that calculation. Basically, the idea would be to convert this H bar ij to the transverse traceless gauge, and then plug it into the formulas, this formula that we have for TAB, and then plug through a lot of algebra, and then convert it back to this non-transverse traceless form. Let me just write down those expressions that you get, and then I'll pin there. So for the gravitational wave flux and the quadruple approximation, so again, this is the time average and evaluated at some retarded time. This is three time derivatives of not the quadruple moment, but this this basically, you take the quadruple moment and subtract out the trace part. So it's the reduced or the trace-free part of the quadruple moment. And then similarly, do a similar calculation for the stress energy, or sorry, for the angular momentum. And you get an expression like that. So a good reference for going through all that algebra, by the way, is Meisner, Thorne, and Wheeler, chapter 6. So I'm way over time here, so I'll just stop and answer any questions you have.
This averaging is time average, whereas the definition of TAB was averaging over wavelengths.
Yeah, well, you can, I mean, you can think of it as averaging it over, yeah, like a, yeah, you can think of it as averaging over, you know, several periods of the gravitational wave or the wavelength of it, either way.
Both of those are the same averaging.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so here you're basically computing some integral over your whole source zone, right? And then it'll have some time dependence, and then you'll want to average over that.